Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
It's a pleasure to welcome you at this early morning here with daylight savings times. People coming from California, especially good morning here, 7 o'clock there, to our session on the science of designing interactions. I'd like to introduce Mingyao Ying. Mingyao came from Singapore, worked at Draper Fisher Jurvetson in Vietnam, and is now running a company called Discoverio in the Bay Area. My name is Andreas Weigand. I teach at Stanford data mining, and I also was the chief scientist at Amazon.com. So interaction is something which is of great interest to both of us. The goals of our session today are, we want to show you some situations where designing interactions can be crucial. We will give you some examples where we extracted some of the underlying patterns. And then, this should be an interactive session, after all, South by Southwest Interactive. We expect you to also participate and give us other examples and give us some insights which we don't have. In order to make that easy, we have here created a link to the Meebo chat room, and that is very easily attached by simply going here, and you see every now and then we'll be showing what's going on there. I'll be monitoring it when Mingyao is speaking and then potentially switch over. There are 7 design patterns, and these are here, our outline, which we will get you through. Basically, I'm giving you the 7 points which we are going to derive during the talk right now. The first one is that we have to think what kind of interactions are we talking about, and we are focusing on the interactions between people. So if you come from interaction design, interacting with content, that's not our focus today, but it's designing interactions between people. The second point is building apps has become very cheap. So build them, experiment, and measure what the results are. We'll give you some examples on that. Now, how do we get people to actually play? How do we get people to interact? One finding is to give user metrics that explain to him or her where they are standing. Fourth, we are providing an economic framework of cost, say the effort people have, of expected reward, what do they get out of it, and last but not least, of the risk which this interaction has, social risks, for instance. Six, we introduce a currency for interactions because economics without currency doesn't work. And then last, Mingyao's term is discovery is new cocaine. We move from simply talking about designing interactions to actually creating mechanisms for discovery. That's what we're in for the next hour. We will put the slides as they are up at the end of the talk. So you don't have to take notes if you don't want to. We promise they will be up at the same location as what we have here, just not a chat, but a slides. Okay. All right. So let's get started. First point is to move from participation to interaction. I'm not an economist, but I know that the cost of communication, the cost of collaboration has dropped dramatically. What is the effect of that? And to some degree, what we're doing today is we are exploring the effect of this cost of communication have dropped to zero. That means that interactions have dropped to zero. The cost of interactions, if you think about the physical, if you will, cost. However, other costs have become the most important costs. Now, collective intelligence is one of these elements what has been possible now. Collective intelligence comes in 3 flavors. There comes problems which you can decompose. An example of that is Amazon's Mechanical Turk. You decompose a problem, you put it in lots of small problems, and you farm it out to the world, no interaction needed. Second one is, and I call this the portfolio approach to the collective intelligence, is where do we benefit from averaging, just like in Wall Street? people have a portfolio. Why do they portfolio? In order to be able to come up with less risk for the same expected return. And thirdly, and that's the one we're interested in, where do interactions actually pay a difference? Think about prediction markets. People interact with each other. As a physicist, I view it as interactions can lead to nonlinearities. If you crank up the volume too much here, you know this positive feedback. That's what we're interested in. How can we create interactions to truly get emergent properties in collective intelligence? So, summary of the first point is we have not just architecture of participation, which Tim O'Reilly so nicely coined, but we're talking today about architectures of interaction, and we frame it the same word in Alexander's pattern, design pattern language. So the first therefore is we want to design interactions. So we already talked about what type of interactions we are considering, and it's not interaction design in the classic UI sense, but it is the design of interactions between people. Some people asked us yesterday, hey, whether this 1 hour is about how to hook up with people. If you want to think about it this way, yes. So it's about creating hookups, about people interacting with each other. Mm-hmm. Now, interactions also have become very simple. And what we have there is that there's both a quantitative way that you have many, 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 many more interactions than before, and a qualitatively much broader spectrum than we ever had. So for the quantitative, because it's so easy, think Twitter. Two nights ago when I was looking for a party, I just tweeted, where's the party? And some guy said, hey, we're hanging out at 6. Okay, pick me up there. These are very, very, very low weight interaction. And probably in this session here, the chat room is already filling up here. In this session, there will be hundreds of interactions happening. But not only this, secondly, there are lots of qualitatively different kinds of interactions. And sometimes we say, is it a universe of lightweight interactions or is it more like a jungle of lightweight interactions? So, fact number one was communication cost is zero. Thus, we can, number one was here, we can design lots of interactions. Fact number two is building stuff has become very cheap. Thus, we can be bold. We create, experiment, and we measure the results. Now, what should we measure, however? Now, the metrics of interaction are also, because so many things can be measured, so many quantitative things are there, and so many kinds of interactions are there, there is a whole spectrum on the left side here. We have users interacting with content. You save something, you tag something for yourself. Mm-hmm. You maybe annotate it for yourself. You star something, give it a star rating to be able to find it later. Then you have primarily interactions with content that you comment on it publicly, that think Amazon reviews, or that you share something with an audience, as we do here. Then you have things which are primarily with others. You forward something to somebody. There's still something about the content, but in addition to the focus on the content, you also have it forwarded to somebody. And sending your tweets here is another example of primarily being for others, although there's content. And lastly, we have stuff which is really primarily just with others. I can wink somebody, I can flirt with somebody, I can be somebody's fan. Those can, by the way, be reciprocal, that like friend requests, I have to wait, and thus there's a longer time scale, less quick reward, or they can just be totally lightweight one way, and we made a Crowdvine room for this hour here, where you can just simply with a push of a button become somebody's fan. Now, when we talk about metrics, many of these metrics, which people invented 10 years ago, are metrics which are of interest to the company. Page views, unique users, all these things which come initially from print, where you know how many copies you shipped and you can estimate how many people read it. But they don't tell you anything about how much they engage with it. So here are some examples of metrics of engagement. And what I want to shift here in the third point, my third therefore of the metrics, is we want to focus on metrics which truly measure user engagement. It is the engagement we're interested in, not just stuff about the page. So for the metrics of engagement, Ming Yao put together some very good examples.
Okay, thank you, Andres. And here we're going to run through some what we consider metrics for users. So what Andres ran through just now was metrics for companies, which is like the stuff that if you're running a website, you would typically measure. Now, what we are proposing today is that what we really need to do is that we need to give the users metrics for themselves such that they can, in turn, change their behavior in accordance to the metrics, right? And you know that's a Maslow hierarchy of needs. So just like each of us individually has our own needs and stuff, I propose that we actually need to provide them metrics, right, that corresponds to this offline real psychological needs of theirs. And such that, again, the key thing, the key criteria for metrics is this. This metric should be allow them to guide their future behavior. Now, let me give you a few examples. Now, this is probably the most common example whereby we give points and their leaderboards, right? And what is probably more interesting is that metrics of popularity and achievement, right? So I guess the standard over the past few years has been, hey, on Facebook, how many friends do I have? But then we have moved from that to become a more, and but that's just a one very, binary way of looking at popularity, right? We have moved from that to become much more granular in terms of how someone can perceive their own popularity in the world. Now, I mean, of course, this example here, like, hey, how many followers in Twitter do you have? Right, that is somewhat a measure of popularity on Twitter. And I'll give you another example here, which is Yelp. Right, and this gives you, and Yelp actually gives the user, right, many different, very small, fine-grained metrics that, hey, they can use to measure themselves by and seek to improve these metrics themselves. Now, the first one is popularity. Hey, how many fans do you have? Right, how many compliments have you given you? And note that all these things are very light, one-way actions taken by other users on them, right? Like, you know, and you know, like you can have one person can be one fan to another guy, or one person can give many compliments to that guy. Another metric here is probably achievement. And you can see here how many restaurants were you the first to review? And similarly, are you a Yelp Elite 208, a Yelp Elite 07? And striving for these achievement metrics, right, allow them to say, okay, this is where I want to be, and this is what I need to do to get there. And last back, of course, is feedback, right? You know, are my reviews useful, funny, or cool? It is quite important to note here that all these things are positive, all right? So what I do is that they add up to accumulate to really give the user a very good sense of holistic feeling about himself. And again, I want to highlight the three things are popularity, achievement, and feedback. And it's really interesting how Yelp actually compressed all these three pretty complex stuff into one very, very single, very, very small box over there. Now, moving on. Now, so we talked about points at the very first slide, and we talked about these metrics of popularity and achievement on the second slide. So what happens when we actually combine the two of them? And here, let me use an example from Facebook app. That's actually a pretty good, compact and concise representation of this. It's called Friends for Sale. If you don't have it yet, check it out, and you can buy me as a friend. So essentially it's very simple. What you do is that you buy and sell our friends, and every time you buy and sell our friends, you get cash, all right? And every time you get bought and sold, you gain in value. So what does that mean? It means that your cash is essentially a power, it represents your power, your achievement that you have achieved, right? And that allows you to buy some really, really pretty girls if you have like 1 million points. And then your value is actually your desirability. And so what we actually talking to a creator, right, something very interesting emerged. He told us that people are actually going crazy over these points. As in, they were asking their friends from all over the world to start logging every 4 hours to get 2,000 points. And then some guy in Saudi Arabia was offering to pay them $10,000 for 1 million points, right, which allowed them to buy about, say, 10 relatively attractive girls in the system. Why? Such that they can give them pets, order them to kiss them, and things like that. You know, so these things are actually pretty powerful I know most of us don't really like Facebook apps here, okay, but I think these are really good, interesting examples of how we can actually study them and learn about how they actually motivate behavior. Now, Andrew, do you mind postponing it? Just pressing postpone. Sorry, Mac. Thanks. So to round off this point right now, Facebook friends for Sale War have 27,000 postings, war postings, and that's like way beyond the second number of higher postings. Why? And the reason is simple. 99% of the 27,000 war postings are say, hey, please buy me. Or it says, or do you want to buy my pets? Right? So it's actually, as you can tell over there and stuff, hey, so people are actually just begging to be bought. So that's also interesting as well. Now, so what we had earlier on was very clear metrics, right? Whereby we say, hey, this is how popular you are, this is how subtle you are and stuff. Now, what is probably a more interesting way, one is probably subtle metrics. What do I mean by that? Subtle metrics of popularity. I think one big thing when Facebook first got started, right, was war postings. And if you look at it this way, displaying the total number of war posting actually does nothing for the user. In a sense, why would I know how many total war posting do I have? But at the start, hey, it was actually a pretty interesting measure of popularity as well. How many people are interested in you? How many people actually bother to write on your war post? And so what Facebook incentivized you to do by displaying this metric here is that they actually incentivize you to write on other people's war posts, such that they write back on your war post. Right, and hence creating an initial kickstart needed for any community to happen. So over here I'll skip over to Andres real quick, whereby he'll talk about observing behavior across users.
Thank you, Mingyao. Do you have any other suggestions, any other ideas, things which you think we really shouldn't have missed in this short summary of metrics? So the point was, it is very easy to build stuff now, it's very easy to measure stuff, it's very easy to interact. And the question I asked here is, what are some of these emergent properties? What are some of these emergent metrics, like points, etc.? Anybody has something, shout it out, and I'll just repeat back here on the microphone or I type it up. What other ideas have you seen beyond the ideas Mingyao just presented?
So some guy here, sorry, not some guy, Eddie says, /dot and dig rating system. Now, we think that /dot and dig rating system, they are good indicators for people to content. In the sense that it's mostly people voting on the content and not so much on people to people, right? So we'll talk a bit about dig later on and about how we think that dig is also shifting towards a more people to people interaction model.
Okay, any other suggestions? Metrics that try to give people some standing in this jungle. Metrics that might incentivize people by simply showing them where they are. Enrique, the example was, I couldn't quite hear you. Okay, a distance to the most popular people, right? So showing your distance to the top people, how many hubs are you away? Here we had another example, rate my blog. So if you see other things, you can add them here. Miguel just brought up as an example, Hot or Not, James Hong's application, which allows people to actually rate. And there's an interesting element which goes towards the addiction here, that you want to figure out whether you're good in predicting actually where somebody stands. Which brings me to the next point, namely the point, once we observe across the site what's going on, then we can build models and we can help making suggestions to the user of what they might want to see. So here are some examples. And the first example is, yeah.
Okay, sure. Okay, so just going on real quick, right? Picking up from the example on Facebook early on right now. The topic right now again is how do we actually observe user behavior across the whole site, right? And hence seek to create more interaction from there. This is an interesting statistic from Facebook. Now, suppose it's a girls' wall, and I post on the girls' wall, and then after that, a guy posted above my posting, right? So I was overtaken by a guy, as opposed to overtaken by a girl, right? I'm 30 times more likely to post again on her wall, all right? As opposed to if another girl had posted on it. So what would Facebook show me on my newsfeed such that to make me want to write on her wall? Obviously, we all know that. So another example here, right, is actually LinkedIn right now. I remember about 1 year ago, I was very happy with my LinkedIn profile. All right, I filled out some fields, I had one recommendation, and I was really happy. And then suddenly, LinkedIn introduced something called completeness. Wow, I'm not complete. Suddenly I was 85%, right? And hey, so he told me, hey, okay, now, Ming Yao, to make your profile complete, you need 3 more recommendations, and you need to fill up this number of fields. I'm like, what the? But I did it anyway. And now I have very happily 100%, and I very happily spammed 6 of my friends and begged them for recommendations. So this is actually a very powerful way, right? That you point out a deficiency. You first establish to user what you think is set the standard or the norm, and you say, hey, you are deficient. And then, hey, they'll do what you want. So another example here, which is probably a pretty interesting example, that how we can actually find out what characteristic of the site that you didn't even notice yourself by actually observing some behaviors. Now, we all know zombie, we all know vampires, we all have been probably bitten by 3 or 4 times, maybe even 10 times, right? But zombies and vampires are actually very, very similar applications. So Brick, the creator of vampires, actually created vampires after zombie. So something he found that was interesting was that for zombies, it was if you're a guy, there's a 50% possibility they'll bite by a guy, and 50% possibility you'll bite a girl, right? But for vampires, it's actually 73%. Means that you're much more likely to bite a girl than to bite a guy, if you're a guy, that is. Why? Because vampire bites have a bit of sexual connotation to it, right? In the sense, you know, like you bite a girl and you convert her, and then she becomes your vampire tree or something like that. So, So it's actually something that what he also noticed is that, hey, you know, that guys really bite a lot of pretty girls, you know, because it's probably something they wanted to do, but then they couldn't do previously, right? That means bite someone. So you do find interesting statistics when you go beyond the analytics, Google Analytics level, and seek to understand how you can trace the behavior between across gender, across demographics, and even across different user profiles. Yep.
Good, and now one thing I want to point out here, this is very different from sort of running site analytics, Google Analytics, something like this, because what we have here is really, we have the rich hypothesis creation, like looking for gender, for instance, between the people, which is very different from just looking for conversion rates in an e-business application. So with this much richer ways of interacting, both qualitatively, many, many different apps, even sometimes within an app, there might be different ways of how we can interact with each other. And with the much richer way of actually having quantitative things that you can, for instance, add things up, or you can just have them binary, we have the ability to truly have being able to actually create very interesting analytics across the site, where the purpose is to help people come up with actions. So for people who came in late, we do have a chat here online, and people are quite active on it, and we encourage you to add, and every now and then we look at things and try to answer them in real time. Okay, so far we have looked at a number of things. First, we learned that we want to focus on designing interaction. We want to build, experiment, and measure. We want to give user the metrics of their standing, and based on the overall stuff which we have seen, not just for the individual user, but for the site across users, we are able to suggest actions. Now, when you look carefully at the LinkedIn example, it turns out you'll be 40 times more likely if you fill things out. to get, you know, a job or whatever it was. Of course, these numbers are made up because it doesn't say 40 times more likely than what. It doesn't give the comparison. But people get the idea, hey, if I just do things, then I'll be do good. The next point is that we want to move towards the economics of interaction. And there are really three elements: cost, reward, and risk. The cost is what I pay for sure. So I buy some shares, for instance, that money goes to the shares. Reward is expected reward. And for those of you who might have a background in machine learning or something like this, reinforcement learning is a wonderful example where for each state action pair, for each action you take in a given state, you have expected rewards and you might want to optimize those. And then finally, risk. Risk is the uncertainty of the reward, second moment. And what that tells us really is, well, what is the worst case which could happen, or what happens with, you know, 99% probability if we're really unlucky? So being positive people, we'll actually start with reward.
Good, thanks. So back to me again. And you know, one very clear point of reward is actually become popular and cool, right? Which is what I pointed about. But the thing about here is that in order for this to be effective as a reward, right, you really need to institute metrics for the users, such that you can say, hey, there's a visible way of him saying that, hey, I'm becoming more and more popular and useful, right? And also, it must be lightweight as well, which it must be very easy for other people to say, hey, you're cool, you're nice, and stuff like that. Otherwise, if we make a very difficult process of actually allowing another user to tell another user you're cool, it's going to be very difficult to, you know, have the kind of feedback needed. Now, another thing here is to, you know, give clear immediate incentives. So this is something that the Stanford Facebook class did to great effect, maybe too great of an effect, such that, you know, it led to quite a lot of backlash and stuff. But essentially, the technique is to say, hey, you know, Steve, we found your best matches. Out of the 40 million people in Facebook, who are going to be the best ones for you? And want to know who they are? Invite your friends. Right? And this is powerful because actually it gives a very clear and immediate incentive, and the action is very clear as well.
Actually, two remarks on that. One is, and I'm not sure whether I'm supposed to tell you that, but those people were picked at random. So just the fact that somebody says, hey, you know, this is a good match for you, start thinking, well, you know, there must be some algorithm. Incidentally, the same what we did at Amazon.com with Goldbox. We put things there at random, and just the fact that somebody tells you, hey, here's some special treasure for you. People think, wow, this is cool. How do they know I'm interested in these things? The second effect here is...
In a way, it's a bit like wood.com, the one item a day thing. It's like, you know, they just share one item and they say, hey, you should buy this. And then you see a lot of people buying it, then you're, oh, okay, maybe I should buy this. So it's something similar.
And the second one is an experiment Dan Ariely told me about, professor at MIT now, somewhere else at UCSC, who just came up with a wonderful book, by the way, called Predictably Irrational. Dan said, Andreas, here's an experiment I did with my students. I told one group of students, well, how much would you pay me if I ask 50 of your friends a certain set of questions about you? $5, yeah. I can ask my friends myself. Okay. Then the other group was told, here is an envelope. In that envelope are answers of 50 of your friends towards the following questions. How much would you pay me for that? Oh, of course, here's your whatever, $100. So the fact that something is concretely there already, if you do those 10 things, if you write those 10 people, we will tell you something, makes it much more likely that people do it than if they have the feeling that it's not there already. Although from an objective perspective, it makes no difference. So many of the things here which we're talking about have deep underlying drivers in behavior economics that people are not, you know, rational agents, but predictably irrational, given that, you know, we evolved heuristics over the last, you know, a few thousand or a few million years, I'm not sure how long the species has been around, which help us deal well with typical situations. And I think it's very interesting to understand which of them help us deal well with online world and which of them might, you know, be better adjusted.
So, Andrew, just to summarize your point, right, what you're saying is that if this thing had been saying that, hey, Steve, invite your friends to find your best match, you have been much less effective, as opposed to what it is now. Hey, Steve, we have found your best match. Is that what I'm saying? Great. So good insight there. So another reward, right, you can give to the user, right, to actually incentivize them to take action, right, is to tell them, you know, how likely is it that you get results, right? Now, this is actually from Get Satisfaction, which is a great site. I don't know if Tor and Lynn is here, but if you guys are here, I love you guys, because you guys have a great website. And what they actually require the user to do is actually to fill in quite a number of fields and stuff, right? More than what is typically for forum posting anyway. And then they, to incentivize them, they say, hey, one last thing before you post. We have estimated the likelihood of your question getting noticed, right? And by giving this very immediate feedback as the thing is going on, actually helps the user understand, hey, more about whether he should invest the effort into filling things out. Another good example here on Get Satisfaction is suggest the action very clearly and set the expected reward, right? Hey, I have this question too, so, and tell me when someone answers. And this actually is, again, a good representation of how we make the reward very clear to the user.
And actually, maybe we should say a couple of words of, in case you didn't see the New York Times a week ago, what Tor and Lane are actually doing. It is the brilliant idea that you want to move the conversations to where the people are, as opposed to trying to move the people onto some website. For instance, take probably many of our favorite airline, United Airlines. I always say, waving a 1K card, they think we are a customer who is happy to be there, but they're just holding us hostage. And we can write, and the response probability is 4%. So now what Get Satisfaction does is it allows you to actually have those conversations on the Get Satisfaction side and then says to the company, hey, it's up to you guys. If you want to respond, good. Here, be our friend, and at united.com suffices for us to identify you. But if you don't want to die, those conversations happen anyways. So that in case you didn't know what the company does. Key point for our designing interactions is you have both interactions which happen between people. People saying, yes, I had that problem too. And then interaction, in this case, between individuals, maybe travelers, and the company's employees.
Great. Okay, so moving on real quick here, is that now, another thing is to really tap on the power of reciprocity. And here are just two simple examples that it's very likely that if you bite someone will bite you back. So that's like, you know, it's something, and the key thing here is lightweight. All right, you don't want to make it very difficult for someone to bite you back. You want to make it very easy for the recipient of the bite to bite you back. All right, and same thing, another very powerful one is top friends here, right, whereby I call you a top friend. Are you going to call me a top friend back? You know, so it's really tapping into these deeper desires of people to reciprocate that really drives interactions, I think. Now,
good. So that was the part where we talked about the rewards. What do people get out of it? Now there are costs associated with it, and for the rewards, I think we live in this great world where the more transparency there is, the better off we are if we have a good product. The product is the message. For the costs, our advice will be reduce friction wherever you can, and I think here also Mingyao put together some examples.
Sure.
Here we are for the costs.
So real quick, right, is that now, you really want to make it very easy for the user. I know everyone has been saying this like forever, but I'd just like to point out a few ways that you can actually make it happen, right? Now, first is capture the moment, right? In the sense that, hey, when someone is reading the review right now, you don't want to make him go to the user profile and say compliment him. You want to make it very clear that, hey, you can compliment the user directly from the review, all right? And you can give the feedback directly from the review, okay? So, and capturing a moment is very important because no one wants to click onto another site and create another page and do something very simple. And here is a very good example of how to kickstart things. All right, so Crowdvine is a relatively new social network that is meant for conferences and groups and so on. Now, I was talking to the CEO, Tony, and he said that one key way interactions get started, right, is actually through this, right? Through these two very simple buttons here, a fan and want to meet, right? What happens? So, for example, say there's this collective intelligence full camp, and I go log in there, and I say, okay, and I see the names who are available. So the moment I do is that, I say, hey, I'm your fan. It's very simple, it's very lightweight, and it's very positive, right? And it only built goodwill for me. And what that guy does is that, what that guy gets an email saying that, hey, Ming Yao is a fan of you. Come and see who you might be a fan of, right? And so it's a very positive and genuine, and the key thing here is it's very lightweight and the one-way indication of interest. And then, if you can think about it, fan is something I say, hey, I admire you and stuff, and one to me is really like saying a hello, right? Think of it in the offline world, and you can see that this really makes sense. The problem with the online world is that too often we make things very hard, right? Like everything must be a formal email, everything has to have a context and things like that. But it's really about creating live interactions that give people reasons, excuses, and to interact.
So now, here actually is an example of what we just set up for you here. We set up, so far it's just Ming Yao and me, because we just did it last night, a network, and CrowdRun is very well designed. And I think sometimes there is no shortcut of just playing with it to really understand those points. We just give you a bunch of things here, but to understand them, I think you just see how different this is from the olden days when Hi5 sends you a message, could you please confirm the following person as a friend by going to this website?
Yep. Okay, now we are running a bit short of time, so I'll be really quick here. And this really, really fast. This really like, okay, no effort needed. By going there, you automatically indicate interest. And risk, right? So you want to talk something about risk?
Yes. The last one also had Xing as an example. Xing, formerly called OpenBC, had as its main driver of revenues for their subscription model is, and we did this by analyzing what is the first thing people do after they actually paid the money, is people were curious and wanted to know who is checking me out. So that, what Xing had 2 years ago, and I used to show it in talks, and there was invariably somebody in the audience said, ah, I don't know, I didn't know that somebody can figure out that actually was Andreas, checking Andreas out. So that's an example that people are curious about themselves. It's about designing interactions. Make that feature possible. And Yahoo bought MyBlogLog. MyBlogLog, of course, makes this much easier right now. And that's what Ming Yao showed on the left. So in finance, when we do simple models, we talk about the cost, minimizing cost. We talk about risks, bounding risks. And we talk about rewards, which is making them transparent. And now, the last point, what we're going to talk about here, are risks. How can we get to the risks? How can we reduce them? How can we bound them? How can we mitigate them?
Sure. So I'm going to make a hypothesis here. I'm going to say that the reason why Twitter succeeded, and it's like it allowed us to do what we really wanted to do all along, which is tell the world what we are doing, right? But without incurring the risk of pissing everyone off. Right. For example, it was 4:30 last night. I really need to sleep. Right. I hate the stupid daylight hours for actually dividing me for 1 hour. But I couldn't email that to anyone before, and I couldn't IM anyone before. So hey, Twitter is just a good way of allowing me to express myself. And the key thing here is optional and lightweight reply. It means that it's not optional. It's optional for anyone to reply. And if they do reply, it's very lightweight to do so. Now, another thing I'll point out here is that how do we reduce? Another point of reducing risk here is about reducing the personal commitment that someone makes to it. So this is Lusk, and it's like you are presented with a picture, and you can have three choices. You can flirt, you can wink, or you can just press next. All right, now, I play around with this app. I found that I wink 20 times. I flirt 0 times. And it makes sense, because I don't really want to make a commitment and say I'm flirting with you. But hey, a wink is OK, right? So, and there's hypothesis by some of my friends that say that, hey, the very existence of the flirt, right, even if no one clicked on the flirt, right, actually makes people click on the wink. Because it actually gives it's about framing again, right? You frame the thing that, hey, this is really heavyweight. Now, this seems really lightweight in comparison. Let me just do it, right? So this again, another interesting understanding of how possible psychology trends can actually help you shape interactions in your app.
There's lots of findings actually in behavior economics. By adding choices nobody picks, you can shift the behavior. For instance, The Economist, the magazine, By adding a choice which nobody picks, namely getting for the same price as you get print and online, just print, by adding that, more people buy print and online than if you remove that choice nobody picks. So that's a good example when you design interactions. How can you frame things so you get people to actually do stuff? And an even simpler one is Starbucks having this XXL triple size coffee nobody buys. Well, we then just set for the half liter cups.
So Idris, I think I just spent 2 minutes talking about Match.com.
Yes. So one of the things is to
Match.com.
Okay.
No, just say Match.com.
So we are now talking about currencies. And introducing currencies, as an example, Dan and I, we went to Match.com, and one of the problems there is that people who have lots of time at their hand and maybe are not that attractive hit up those people who are very attractive and maybe don't have that much time on their hand. So how do you deal with this asymmetry? How do you deal with that imbalance? And actually, it's the same problem, for instance, at LinkedIn, that those people who are desperate of finding a job usually are not the ones you, you know, want, if you actually are very successful and have lots of connections, want to deal with. So one idea Dan Ariely had was to say, well, we create a currency here. We give people virtual roses. And when you create a currency, you have to think about many things. For instance, can you bank virtual roses? Can you keep them? Or you have to think, can you trade virtual roses? So if I don't need one and I give mine to Ming Yao, can he use it? And can you buy virtual roses or should? So introducing a whole system of a whole currency allows people to then get through and say, you know, let's say you want to talk to Jeff Bezos. You maybe get one golden bullet a week. So you can use your bullet to tell Jeff, you know, this is the one bullet I have this week. I really would like to talk to you. So that's, I think, one of the examples of creating currencies. Okay. So finally here, we have some other examples of the currencies. And the standard example here would be reputations, like on eBay. eBay is an example. Why do we do this? Because we want to have shortcuts of predicting what the outcome is. So eBay, of course, cannot tell you whether the person really is a good guy, really will deliver what you're ordering right now from them. But all they have is the past. They can tell how the behavior was in the past, and the purpose of reputations is that people can make decisions based on aggregate data from the past. As an example here, is that reputation might not just be a one-dimensional object. So for instance, if you say there might be a site of knowledge, I might be really good in when it comes to machine learning, but when it comes to building machines, I might really suck. So reputation might be a multi-dimensional object, and it might help us to actually get things together from the past. Another one, where we take examples from the past is to deal with our inbox. And here, Xobmi, which is inbox, read, of course, backward, looks at a number of data points from how I have behaved in the past, but also from maybe who I'm interacting with. So for instance, if you want to send me a message, but you've never sent me a message, then the fact that you and Ming Yao are friends and Ming Yao and I am friends, might make that message come through to me with much higher probability than if you actually don't have anybody in common with me. Or another example, say, Quentin Hardy. Anybody who gets a message from him, immediate response. So the system knows, and that's only based on header information, the system knows, hey, Quentin has stuff to say. And so if he has a question, well, it's definitely worth it for me to answer it. So these are examples of implicit or explicit currencies, of just learning from these data to mitigate interactions, because we now live in a world where potentially, because the cost having dropped, we can have so many more interactions than we can ever deal with, that we need to take whatever we can find, which helps us to get around here. So with all these interactions, discovery, discovering people, potentially interacting them, is not only useful, but can even be addictive. If you think about addiction, there are a number of properties which lead to addiction. And if you think about, for instance, day trading, people are addicted to day trading, MMORPGs, massively online role-playing games, people get addicted to them. Or dating sites. I did some work with gay.com, and it turned out that some people click on thousands of profiles. So what's happening here? What's happening is the world is changing whether you are there or not, and that makes you come back. The same clearly is the case for Facebook, that people come back because they want to know, hey, did anybody kiss me? Did anybody poop? What happened? So you have a stake at it, whether it's in day trading or whether it's in Facebook, and it draws you back to see, are there any connections I can make?
So I'll round off this session with a few examples of discovery. Okay, and the hypothesis is simple. Now, as users, right, or as individuals, we want to discover ourselves, we want to discover people around us, and we want to be discovered by other people as well, right? So it's really these three components of discovery that we'll run through real quick. Now, first of all, it's that, now, remember those personality tests that you used to take, right, that tell you about ENTP, INTP, or whatever that you are and stuff? Now, this is actually what we might consider a new personality test, but the only difference is that, of course, you are not taking it, but other people are taking it for you, right? Whereby, so it's actually, you know, people, these users discovering themselves of what others really think about them. Hey, what does that girl really think about me? You know, something like that. And, I mean, again, Facebook are a good, concise examples of this. You have characteristics, superlatives, and compare people. All very, very popular apps, right? That really make it very easy for someone to actually say, hey, I'm interested in, what do I think of you? Now, next is now, in this age of, you know, so many interactions, so much information, so much people, right? We really need one key differentiating factor right now is to really innovate in helping users discover, okay? And Flickr is probably the more common example, interestingness, whereby they take all sorts of data, comments, views, and everything else, and you know, they try to tell you which is the more interesting one, right? And an example that I really encourage all of you to check out is Etsy, all right? And you can see that it's not realistic to show it here, but do check out how they allow someone to explore Time Machine 2, categories, the normal one, Pounds, Geolocator. You don't even know what those are, all right? I mean, but what it does is that it really induces a bit of surprise, unpredictability into the system, right? And to allow people to actually step out of the traditional boundaries. Let us contrast this a little bit. If you go on eBay right now, you always be in one category, right? You always go to, say, laptops, or you go to iPod and stuff. You never discover new things, right? So what actually does very well is actually to introduce a stream of stuff that actually allow you to discover new things that you might be interested in, and that's extremely powerful there. By the way, that's also a reason why they recently closed a $27 million round by Union Square. So another example here is, and a good distinction to make here is now, discovery can come in two ways. Is it algo-based discovery or is it human-based discovery? All right, and you can see Dig here. Dig here is obviously very traditionally an algo-based discovery. You have an algorithm, you have users voting, and then they show you the top readers and stuff. But what I think could be really interesting is as they shift towards allowing users to discover via users, because ultimately that is a lot more personal. You have a set of users that you are really interested in, that you think really give you good stuff, and ultimately, I believe, this is my personal belief here, that Dig will need to shift from a one-size-fits-all model towards really catering towards allowing people to follow people. Right? And that's a big shift, and we'll see if this prediction comes true, and if they really make it happen. And a last screenshot is discovering via homepage, and the other one is discovering via users. Right? Next is a really simple one, but very powerful as well. You can see, just based on latest update, right? You know, you discover who has recently updated their profile, and who has recently commented and stuff. And guess what? You would want to update your profile, and you would want to comment, because you want to be discovered, right? Because once you comment, and once you update your profile, you'll be on the front page, and that increases the chance of being discovered. All right, so it is all about building in this implicit understanding to the user that, hey, if you do something, you'll be discovered. That is powerful. And moving on from a time-based kind of ranking to a more intelligent one, it's probably Facebook feed, the most famous example, right? And Facebook actually knows very well who I'm interested in. Ahmad is my good friend. This guy, I always click on his events, and this girl, I always check out. All right, so Facebook actually knows very well who I'm interested in, things like that. And again, my hypothesis is that this is the main reason why people keep going back to Facebook nowadays, right? And despite all the fact that the novelty of many of the interactions have actually dropped off. And again, but one key thing to understand is that discovery alone is not enough, right? Now, for example, I have discovered everyone in the room here today, but who should I connect with? Who should I talk to, right? And this goes to the next point. It's really like give people a reason to interact, all right? Like, for example, Yelp. So we went to a few different examples whereby, you know, these things come true. For example, Yelp, right? Now, reviews are the connecting point. Tom Gieselman from BV Capital calls it externalities that allow people to connect, right? And over here on Yelp is reviews. And again, they are great starting points to express interest and to establish connection, all right? Now, a more interesting example is this CrowdVine again, and they are building this new social network for Apache Conference. And now, what is interesting about Apache Conference is that there are many people who work on these open source projects, but they got no idea who the people really are working together on. So they allow users to say, hey, what are your favorite Apache projects? And what Apache projects have contributed to? And then people discover who have actually worked on projects together than before. And so it becomes a very simple thing, right? Hey, hit them up before the conference on CrowdVine, and in the conference itself, make friends, right? So it's really about giving people reasons and projects and things like that to really allow them to interact. Now, one last point here is probably, again, the most famous point, Facebook again. Is tagging Facebook pictures, notes you tag your friends, and then that forms an ad hoc emergent conversation around the picture, around the note, and so on and so forth. And you know, given the variety of ways that Facebook really makes it happen, it's probably no surprise that you know, they are where they are right now. So summarizing the discovery point, I think we have moved from a place whereby pure interactions is enough to really needing to create the elements of addiction that Andres was talking about, right? Things happen even when you're not around, things are out of your control and things like that. And you really allow people to insert that in that unpredictability and surprise element. I think ultimately that will be what separates the next generation of apps from the others.
Okay. So we have been doing well on time. We have about 7 minutes left as we planned. And we want to open up the floor for any discussions you might have. First of all, I would like to ask you whether you have other examples, potentially also examples that failed, where people tried to design interaction, but it just wasn't happening. And then we can figure out together why might that have been the case. And then a good exercise to actually make it concrete at the end is to think about in whatever application you have, whatever world you're in, what possibilities of interaction can you create? What specific one would be important? And finally, what is the next ever small step you could take towards it? So that is what we had planned for the end, but I would like to open up. Please come to the microphone if you have any comments, questions, or if you would like to address any of these points here. Quentin.
I think the currency idea is great, and it's obviously a good sorting mechanism to find some sort of value. The currencies typically seem to be specific to the site, the activity. They're around the values people ascribe inside that system, which kind of reminds me of a lot of the early history of money in banking itself, where you had thousands of different banks issuing thousands of different kinds of currencies. And I wonder if it's possible now or in the future to have a central bank that has a single clearing authority that takes attributes and has some kind of gold standard that backs one's, really this is a currency of identity and reputation and the value you get off that. In some ways the currencies play off our insecurities about ourselves, how well thought of, our need for esteem. Do you think it would be possible to create a central bank that served as a repository for all these different websites, communities, what have you?
So So the easy answer, of course, for the currencies would just be to say, well, ultimately, money will be an exchange rate, and exchanges will be floating between them. But that's not the answer I wanted to actually give. There's much deeper stuff. Second, before I get to the deeper answers, actually, I talked to Jeff Hammerbach of Facebook, who is in charge of all the data there. And I was very surprised that he actually, Facebook people, really have the deep perspective in saying, well, ultimately, it might be the government who is taking care of those identities and not a for-profit company. And then I think the third point here is, if you think about how we started, that it is easy to communicate, it's cheap, it's easy to build apps. So maybe it is that we'll just have a very high-dimensional construct of identity, where, for instance, I could get each of you, as you leave today, a random number, say a 12-digit random number, and that would identify you, if I keep a link here of what we have, that would identify you as having been part in the session. But we can track down who you really are as an individual. So having new algorithms where people can show their membership to groups or having been in a session, which does not allow us to track down the individuals, that is another mosaic stone, and I think where we will see a lot of trading of identities. It's no longer one-to-one. It might be one-to-many that I have a bunch of identities on the web.
In that sense, everybody would be a central bank. They'd have a repository of their own values and people
Yes, so what Quentin is saying, that everybody might be a bank, and identity is a very complex concept. It might be one-to-many, but it also might be many-to-one. I did a project for the World Economic Forum, and there, one ID actually was used by some executive plus his assistant. So, as we saw before, we had, you know, in the olden days, postcards or letters, you buy a stamp, you bring it to the post office, that was the way to communicate. Now we have multiple ways, and I think the same will be true for identities as well, where we can potentially even, sell some part of our identities. An example for that is virtual item trading, where Thailand throttled its internet connectivity at night because they felt it was a problem for the country that so many Thai teenagers were playing online role-playing games in order to sell those characters which they created. Next question.
Hello, Andreas. I mean, so more than a question, I think there is like an eighth design pattern to be included. It's implicit, I guess, on the seven ones that you have. It is the timeliness of the interactions. And it's important to mention that explicitly because it has an impact on the algorithms and all the back-end infrastructure to make it fast or quicker to make meaning out of it.
Is your point to say that there needs to be a time-based design pattern as well? Design pattern takes the temporal effects into consideration?
I'm saying that some of this interaction needs to be on real time, or it doesn't have to be real time to make meaning out of it.
I see. So the gentleman's point was that there are a lot of communications that need to be in real time in order to make sense of it. And I agree completely. I think that's one area that we probably missed out. And there's a company that I really recommend all of you guys check out. It's qik.com, quick.com, which actually allows live streaming from the phone. So you actually install a software on your phone, and anywhere you go, you can just stream it, and anyone can actually chat on it and read it online. So that's really cool. Yeah, I agree. So it would be really great if you can have a chat later on to see how we can actually incorporate some of these things into the design pattern we have. Thanks.
Good. We are out of time. Mingya, I would like to thank you for all the hard work. I was just sitting here talking a little bit about the slides. He did all the work. And I would like to thank you for participating. These are the ways of actually reaching us. We are here until Tuesday. And do welcome any conversation, any interactions you might want to have.
So just one last thing, right? It's a shameless plug. As you guys know, we are having a new company called Discoverio. And the company is really trying to, allow you to find, discover people that really complement your goals. All right, not in a superficial manner as in poke and stuff, but really complement your goals. So, and you'll be putting all the things you talked about into practice, and if you're interested in part of the process, either just to talk about it or to really be part of it, I'll really appreciate if someone talked to me. Thanks.
Thank you very much.